On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Joined in the studio by Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with the Independent, Sunday Independent, as I said, and also by Sheena Cahill, former board member of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, former president of the Union of Students in Ireland. Hugh, I'd imagine that, I don't know whether I'm overanalyzing or reading too much into what Paul Reid said at the end there, but he was sort of saying that this is an issue for government, that I can imagine some accountant sitting over the figures this morning and saying, if there's tens of thousands of people who can sue us for tens of thousands each over the release of their data or it not be safeguarded in appropriate ways, that there's a case to be made, regrettable as the idea is, of trying to pay off these criminals and hoping that the problem goes away.
Well, there is, but I mean, the government's been very clear all week that it won't pay a ransom, it won't negotiate with these people, and so that's the position. And to pull back from that position, I think, would be an enormous decision from the government that would... create a whole host of other issues down the line in terms of, well, if we pay this ransom, will we pay other ransoms in future if data is stolen from some other state agency or hacked by some other state agency? So I can't envisage a situation where the government decides to pay the ransom on this or to withdraw from the position that it has adopted. So I think it just has to prepare for the situation that you outlined there, where people sue the state, or the situation where thousands, if not millions, of people next week are subject to extortion attempts, or not just next week, but in the coming weeks, months, and years.
Nearly as difficult as that would be, and as difficult it is to swallow the idea of handing over $20 million to a criminal gang and thereby resourcing them to do other stuff in the future.
The other thing about that, Gav, is that there's no guarantee that would work. These are bad faith actors. So there's every chance and every possibility that you pay the $20 million, and it doesn't stop them doing all of the things that they're threatening.
True, but I've also heard the argument made, including by one guest who was on last weekend with Susan Keogh on News Talk Breakfast, making the argument that, funny as it is to treat them this way, this is a gang with a business model, and if they are seen to go against the ethos of the business model, if it's very publicised that a state paid it $20 million and that they didn't destroy the data, then no one else is going to do it.
But I mean, I think, there are no good options here ultimately, but I think one of the things that the government's not sure, or at least from people I've spoken to, is not sure why the encryption key was handed over. But one of the reasons they're speculating, and I think it's well grounded, is this idea that the hackers did not realise the import of what they were doing, that they've created an enormous controversy by doing this. They've hacked a health service, they've stolen data. And previous examples of this having happened in Germany, where hackers broke into a university, they thought they were breaking into a university system, were actually breaking into the system of a university hospital.
Didn't realize it was going to kill
people. I spoke to someone yesterday who suggested that actually someone had died as a result of that, or that there was some situation in Germany where a person had died as a result of the hacking situation. And the hackers back down. So, I think that that might be the reason why the encryption key was handed over in this instance. And I think that's a sign, perhaps, that the hackers are backtracking somewhat.
Yeah.
But I don't see a situation where the state backs down in terms of trying to pay the ransom. And I do think that ultimately there are no good options here. There are no good outcomes here. And we're going to be grappling with this for weeks, months and years.
Personally, I suspect that the reason why they've handed over the decryption key is because they're trying to reframe the debate as around $20 million to us and the problem goes away versus, take the moral high ground and then deal with the fallout, which could be more far-reaching. Sheena Cahill, there's a lot written across all of today's papers. Anything that jumps out for you on this?
Well, actually, on the decryption thing, I think it was John Mooney in the Sunday Times kind of made the point that the decryption key being handed back might be to do with intimidation. It's actually an intimidation tactic. That it's like, we have the upper hand, we still have the upper hand, we're going to continue having the upper hand. So we're going to maybe give you the key back to your house, but, we have all your stuff, or we have copies of all your stuff. And I think
it's
that's
like a proof of life in a hostage situation almost.
Yeah. And I mean, look, this whole thing is like, it's cyberware. There's visuals of like hoodied young fellas and there's numbers over their heads and it's all very dramatic, like a 12PG Hollywood film. But like
the stock photos aren't very, not much variety in them.
There's not much variety. But the whole thing is that like, and I think there's a couple of pieces across papers this morning that kind of point out examples of the real people affected by this. And while it's obviously great that we're, a very tired Paul Reid is coming to you from, a vaccination centre, and there is much progress and there's a lot of positive to be taken by that. Just the idea that you know, this information is out there. And it's just so scary. But I think the thing as well about the social media companies and the High Court injunction and all that kind of stuff this week, it's kind of like, well, these lads like aren't like on Instagram, like putting up putting up your information. Like this is all on dark web. So it's like a whole other level of just maliciousness. And I do agree with you with the take that obviously I don't think this was meant to be a health service. I think they were just searching for a weak spot in a server. They found this. But I don't hold the view that handing back the decryption key is them being sorry about it. I actually think it's them just kind of saying, look, we have your stuff. Here's the key, but we have copies of everything in the house.
Yeah, one tweet already on the record, NT. The hashtag, I'd rather pay the legal penalties to our own citizens than pay a ransom to international criminals, which I think is possibly the government's own thinking on this, that they would rather deal with the bigger consequences and retain the sense of morality around all of this. Sheena, do you think that the state has taken our defence, not just the HSE, but rather all of this idea of, you know, internet warfare and cyber attacks and all that, do you think it's ever really been taken seriously enough up until now?
No, because I think it's actually the Sunday Business Post runs with, you know, the line that the FBI are now involved, and that kind of makes it more exciting and sexy, doesn't it? And I think, but that, you know, I'm making a flippant point about the fact that I actually don't think we take cybersecurity seriously as a state in general. You know, I believe the unit in the Defence Forces had been kind of like defunded in recent years. You know, I think the HSE itself hadn't got a chief risk officer appointed. The person who was supposed to take it earlier this year stepped back for personal reasons. Now they're saying, look, let's up the money and bring somebody in. But, you know, like we don't. And I mean, then you're thinking like, if this is bad, and I know that actually Paul Reid himself used the phrase, you know, the system is not very integrated. And we all know how paper-based the HSE has been. And like Windows 97 that some of these nurses are using to try and type in some of the information. How bad could it have been even worse if we had been more in, you know, actually without all the paper-based stuff? But no. The answer to that question is I don't think the state takes this seriously.
As someone in government said to me last week, you know, the choice in terms of the health service and funding these kind of issues is do you throw loads of money at that, or do you use it for like frontline healthcare? And so that is the choice ultimately. You know, you have a limited amount of money. And you have to decide whether, you know, you fund scanning machines or X-ray machines or whatever.
Or intangible security stuff for
a threat that might never occur. But look, I mean, obviously, this is, this is a massive issue that, you know, a lot of people I've spoken to about it have said that the system will now be more resilient as a result of this, and that it will be better able to cope with potential attacks in the future. But I think ultimately, you know, no amount of money is going to stop these people from doing these kind of things. And so you build a system, you build a firewall or whatever, and they'll find a way in the future to get around it. So, you know, that's just going to be the realities that we're always going to be grappling with these kind of things.
We'll talk more about the state's approach to cybersecurity with the Minister for Communications, Eamon Ryan. He's with us after 12 o'clock. It's reported in the Mail on Sunday that Croke Park could have up to 30,000 people in it for the All-Ireland Hurling and Football Finals this coming August. Hugh O'Connell is also writing on page 3 of the Sunday Independent about a pilot event, including crowds at gigs and games. Hugh, when are we going to be going back to Coppers, and do you have your glow sticks ready?
Do you have your gold card?
I do not have a gold card. I do not have any glow sticks, but I suppose I can say, and I don't know if there will be any events in Coppers, but certainly the government's looking at a bunch of pilot music events this summer, indoor and outdoor, large and small venues, you know, with a view to trialling, I suppose, how these work out. We saw a number of events in the UK in the last few weeks. I think they had 9 events between, you know, the FA Cup final, the Brit Awards, these kind of things. They had a large nightclub event in Liverpool. And of the 60,000 attendees at these various events, they had 15 positive COVID-19 tests. So, I mean, that indicates that these things can work. I mean, the UK is a bit more advanced in its vaccination program.
And they were controlled environments because everyone was taking lateral flow tests before they went in.
That's right, but there was no social distancing and no face masks. So this is the sort of stuff that, you know, we took for granted pre-pandemic that will slowly begin returning.
Loads of shifting as well.
Loads of shifting,
11:35 for anyone who had the loads of shifting sweepstake open this morning. Thank you, Sheena. Do we have any kind of timetable for when all of this might kick off, Hugh? Because I found up until now that ministers have been very circumspect, and they've talked about how you might have outdoor crowds at, you know, outdoor club GAA matches come July anyway, but that they wouldn't be any more specific about the numbers that they're looking at or when we could be looking at these trials.
Yeah, look, it's all in the realm of speculation, let's be honest, up until you know, the government makes a decision later this week. I mean, NPHET's meeting on Thursday and the cabinet's going to meet on Friday, and then there'll be an announcement from the Taoiseach. But I mean, I think we're looking at kind of late June, July. I think Catherine Martin, the tourism minister, said that last week, that she wanted to try and run some stuff from late June onwards. So, but I think, you know, you're going to be in July and August when you're going to be getting, like, you know, a lot of these events happening, I think. And I think, you know, the Mail on Sunday is suggesting today 30,000 people in Croke Park for the All-Ireland finals. That's certainly something that that could be possible, provided that there isn't a surge in cases and that the you know, the next phase of the reopening in terms of you know, hospitality doesn't lead to a significant spike in cases. But I mean, look, so far, NPHET, in their briefing during the week, you know, didn't indicate that the reopening had led to any significant surge or any significant jump in the reproductive rate of the virus. The only issue is the black cloud, as Tony Holohan described it, of the so-called Indian variant, of which there's been a significant increase in the number of cases detected in Ireland of that. It's more transmissible, but the evidence seems to be that the vaccine works against it. So that's all very positive.
New evidence published by Public Health England this morning about that. Yeah, that you get full protection after your two doses, but the concern is that you might still be vulnerable to it after only one of your two doses, which does perhaps call into question the English decision to increase the space between the two Pfizer doses to 12 weeks. And maybe it's been a kind of a belated happy coincidence that Ireland has advised against that, because it could mean we're slightly better protected. Gina, there's two ways of looking at us following the UK's lead in sort of trialling all these events. You could say, well, yes, we're further behind in the curve, that we have fewer people vaccinated, so naturally we're going to be a few months behind Britain. But there's also plenty of arguments made across the water that they've been too cautious about trying these things, and that really maybe they should have been trialling these warehouse raves and everything maybe months previous.
Yeah, I know. Like, I mean, Hugh just mentioned the, like, the black cloud thing, right? And you're kind of looking at the weather in Ireland and you're like, I don't know how many more black clouds you can have. It's been tropical. In relation to that kind of, like, no harm, Hugh. I absolutely hate these articles that, like, give us this bit of hope. You know, you're thinking about, God, I could have been watching the Eurovision in the George last night, you know. We could have just had a, you know, we could have been the trial. The gays could have been the trial. But
you could send the entire population of Longford to Croke Park for the Leinster final.
But, like, not I don't so know, like, I'm afraid of the, of like, you know, the Daily Mail run with 30,000 potential in Croke Park, because I just don't want it to not happen, because, like, the whole meaning of the word plan, or, like, Micheál Martin is love saying comprehensive plan is coming, and you're like, but what does comprehensive mean anymore, you know? So am I frustrated with the fact that we haven't done these trials? Yeah, because I think it'd be nice to give a whole, like, batch of brilliant artists and musicians and event people who've been crippled by this entire time an opportunity to show their creativity again. And
I mean, the one note of caution, I suppose, is that last summer, I remember there was talk around 10,000 people at Croke Park for the All-Ireland finals in December.
But that was based on a kind of an irreversible program of relaxing restrictions over last summer and then never having to go back.
Yeah, well, exactly right. So, but I mean, look, the vaccine is the game changer. Like, and we heard Paul Reid earlier, we're at, you know, 300,000 doses a week. Yeah. I mean, who would have thought that a few weeks ago when there was you know, all that crack going on at the Beacon and this, you know, the slow pace of vaccination at weekends and the supply issues and all this kind of stuff. But it's really motoring now, and there is a sense of momentum, I think, across the political system anyway, that we are reopening and we're not going to be in a situation where we're going to have to shut down again.
Sheena, I've had to apologise to you on this programme before for you sort of a token voice of young people.
But right.
I'm sorry to typecast you once again on this. But there's a few pieces written in today's papers around the idea of needing to give people some sort of extra incentive to get their vaccine. And there's
all the talk in
the United States, Luke O'Neill's piece in the Sunday Independent today, among others, talking about, you know, free beer or whether you should enter you into a lottery or whatever. There is a kind of a legitimate question when you get to those who are in their 20s, who are probably going to be the last ones, who, A, we might already, all going well, have reached herd immunity by that point, but also it's the final category of people who are least likely to have any adverse, like, health outcome as a result of COVID. You might get to a point where those in their 20s sort of go, ah, it's grand, the problem's gone away now, and don't avail of a vaccination. What do you do to make sure they do?
I know. I read Luke's article, and I know. I think. I mean, at least I took it as it was kind of a humorous take on, you know, maybe we should have these vaccinations at the Spire, or like, you know,
because it reminds you of needles.
Yeah, or in castles or whatever. And, but from just, you know, from, I suppose, experience or from talking to people in a non-peer reviewed way, I just don't see why we would be doing that for the young cohort. Absolutely. The concern would be that interest in getting vaccinations would drop off. But I think it's more just that, you know, if we run with the clubs will open sooner and everything else about your life can start again, I think people will go ahead and get the vaccination. I don't think that there's as much concern maybe here as in other states about the level of kind of issue that young people have with
you don't
with
agree with the Luke O'Neill hypothesis of the Guinness Storehouse giving you a free pint if you show up with your vaccine certs, or Electric Picnic offering entry only to those who are vaccinated, perhaps?
Yeah, like I don't agree with the idea of incentives to vaccinate. That would be my approach to it. But if someone was to give me a free Guinness or entry to Electric Picnic, I don't think myself or anyone else under 30 would say no to that.
Just going back to shifting, I was reading something in the US.
Yes!
Said no one ever on this show.
I was reading a story in the US that some of the dating apps are offering a kind of a vaccinated option, you know, that you, on your profile it says you're vaccinated. And the evidence shows that there's an increase in the number of matches that you would have if you're vaccinated.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is it swipe right? I don't even know. Yeah. But yeah, so I suppose, you know, there's another incentive potentially in terms of vaccination that you're more likely to pull.
The vaccine bonus that nobody saw coming.
Yeah.
There you go. Don't say we don't cover all bases on this programme. Still joined by Sheena Cahill and Hugh O'Connell discussing what's in this morning's newspapers. And Sheena, there is an awful lot still written about the state of the housing market, about the role of cuckoo funds, whether what was done this week will be enough to deter them. It is difficult to know where to start. Is there anything that jumps out for you?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what I was annoyed about. I was annoyed about Conor Skeehan's article in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know where to start with that article now, lads. Like, you know, somehow I'm also one of these people that I've been taken in by the myth of victimhood among renters. I mean, collective sigh. And I mean, I read that article through gritted teeth now. And I mean,
can you explain, without asking you to channel Conor Skeehan, can you explain exactly what he says is the myth of victimhood?
Just that we've been told by the media that
there's a housing crisis.
That there's a housing crisis, and the housing crisis doesn't actually exist. You know, it's actually ourselves, and that we like renting. Mm. You know, generation rent, also a myth. Mm. Oh, yeah, because
what's more attractive than spending about a grand more in rent than you could buy the same place for?
Yeah, the words like dead rent also, you know, or dead money, you know, he compares it to like buying your grocery shopping because you eat the food and then you move on. So that's also dead money. And I was like, here. I suppose that was the one that kind of jumped out at me. Sorry, Connor, I guess, but look at the whole, housing in general. I mean, Hugh has a great article, and I'm not going to try
you
and paraphrase
to
it.
That.
but yeah, I think it's just been one of those kind of depressing weeks. I'd say, you know, the piece about the hard hat, I think was great. I mean, I gave me a chuckle this morning because the idea that the health minister was kind of saying, look at, to Dara, best of luck, lad, and thanks for taking the heat off me for a while, you know.
There is definitely that sense in government that Donnelly has sort of, is no longer the most embattled and most under fire minister, the focus has shifted to O'Brien. But I mean, O'Brien
is
well able to handle that, you know, and
the Conor Skeehan's piece, the first time buyer is a myth that needs to be put into perspective as the ultimate tiny tail that's wagging a very big dog. There are about 2 million homes, houses and apartments in Ireland. Out of about 24,000 annual house purchases, only around 6,000 are first-time buyers. That means that national policy is driven by the needs of one-third of 1% of all homeowners and one-quarter of annual sales.
But you see, that point is complete nonsense if you think about it, because why is it that it's only that number? Because it's hard to be a first-time buyer. It's hard to get on the property ladder, so that's the issue.
The problem isn't so much that it's a small portion, it's the fact that it's actually so small that they ought to be able to afford it.
There's a reason that it's so small is because the people are finding it very hard to buy a house.
Generation,
because they're stuck in rental.
Generation rent is a myth-making trope.
It's in our heads, Gavin.
That it's used to persuade people that they're victims. Through boom and bust for over 50 years, Irish people have been increasingly choosing to rent rather than to buy. Today, 30% of us rent, a sign that Ireland is maturing to align with the European norm in advanced economies.
Like, I think Connor's piece is a contribution to the debate that obviously is generating a lot of anger in this studio this morning. But I mean, I think it's important that those views
keep
are aired.
But
I think that anyone who tries to dismiss what's going on at the moment as not really a crisis and not really an issue, I think is off.
I think his idea that we are selectively choosing to become a very rent-centric society. If you were to compare
us, it's not selective.
Well,
no.
Yeah, if you were to compare us with other societies, in other societies, you pay a premium. Like if you're buying somewhere or you're renting somewhere, the mortgage costs you more, and that's the way the market is supposed to work, because you're supposed to pay a premium in order to own the thing when you're finished with it. It's not supposed to be the case that it would be cheaper to own if only you could pull together the deposit, which most people can't do because of the cost of housing in the first place.
Yeah, but like, I mean, the idea that there is no housing crisis. I mean, we weren't building homes for years, and we didn't build enough homes last year, obviously because of the pandemic, and we need to be building 33,000 or thereabouts a year, and that is a target that is some way off.
And like, in stark contrast, I suppose, to Connor's article, and I will labour no more on that, but Jean Kerrigan at the back of the Independent in opinion just said, you know, those who control the cost of putting a roof over our head, either buying or renting, are moulding how we live, forcing people into social shapes or societal shapes they would not otherwise adopt. So people are making huge decisions, including putting off having children, basic decisions about where and how they live are in the hands of others. And like, that is actually the reality.
This is Connor's game, by the way, the chair of the housing agency, and he once did accuse some people presenting as homeless of gaming the system because he basically argued that they were trying to jump the queue for social housing, which then had to be dismissed by pretty much everyone else who works in his company. Like I said, so much on housing. Anything else that jumps out for you this morning?
No, Michael Brennan, I think, though, has a good piece in the Business Post, just kind of saying, you know, he makes the point that towards the end of the piece, basically, that NIMBYism is a factor as well. I think he raises the case of the Central Mental Hospital, or the site of the Central Mental Hospital in Dundrum. I think there's a plan for over 1,000 homes.
There are concerns being raised about traffic on the road.
Residents are concerned about the extra traffic that building new homes and putting people there will create. And I think that's a land development agency plan. And you know, making the point that okay, there's lots of issues in terms of supply, but one of them is NIMBYism, and I think that's a problem as well. And you know, my colleague Philip Ryan had a good tweet earlier in the week about how they're all at it, which is basically politicians of all colours have objected to housing developments in their own constituencies for years, and that is hard to stomach in a scenario where we have a housing crisis. So and then for example, you know, Johnny Ronan is in the Sunday Independent today. Yeah. Giving out about the On Bord Planola refusing his development down in the Docklands. You know, there's an argument to make about whether
taller than the strategy or the development plan permits.
Exactly, yeah. But I mean, you know, there's an argument to be made. Okay, well, you know, is he building homes that are going to be affordable? Well, you know, some arguments to say that, well, he's building homes. Jesus, we need to build a lot of homes.
Well, as Ben Tonra, a professor of industrial relations in UCD, tweeted yesterday morning, we demand housing, but just not built there and not built here and not built like
that way.
And not built by them or not built for them, not paid for by us, not paid for by them, not bought by them, not that size, not that high, not that far away, not that close, but we still need the housing.
Exactly.
But then, Sheena, how do you get around that? Because if everyone is entitled to raise concerns or to lodge objections to planning, and if everyone still feels like when they live somewhere that they do have some kind of authority over the direction of their district or whatever, how do you get over NIMBYism? Like, what do you do to stop people who genuinely want to keep the character of the neighbourhood that they live in?
I mean, potentially,
how do you balance it?
Yeah, I mean, potentially it's greater in engagement with local county councils and regional planning. I mean, I think that you can bring people on a journey about zoning well in advance, you know, and we're not really doing that. Like, but one of the things you notice, like, there's a lot of places that are zoned for residential, and then you'll be like, I think they're looking at doing kind of like a 3-year stoppage on, like, you can't keep objecting after.
Barry Cowan has suggested
Yeah, and like, I mean, the idea that we've successfully gotten councillors to sign off on residential zoning, and then everything stops, and you know, the sod of turf being turned, that doesn't make any sense to me. Particularly if you've gotten that far with the local politicians. So
yeah,
I certainly don't have the answer, Gavin, to be honest, about how
the big fear factor for a lot of people is, you know, creating creating ghettos, you know, creating all the situation, like the huge blocks out in Ballymun and all the social problems that that created because there wasn't the right infrastructure there around that and the amenities and so on. Ghost estates. Remember Ghost estates? I mean, you know, they haven't gone away, I suppose, but the building developments in areas where they shouldn't have been built. So there's the risk or the aversion to building the wrong type of houses in the wrong type of places stems from that. But it doesn't solve the crisis. You know?
Hugh, in 10 seconds, do you think what's been implemented by the government this week, a 10% stamp duty on the bulk purchase of houses and duplexes, will it do enough to deter cuckoo funds?
Impossible to say at this stage, but I think in terms of the tax measure, we'll find out pretty soon whether that works. In terms of the planning measures from Dara O'Brien, it'll be several years before we see the impact of that.
I can only imagine the holy hell that will be waged if we discover that it wasn't enough and that some other cuckoo fund still comes along and buys second-hand housing estates. We'll leave it there. Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with Independent Newspapers. Sheena Cahill, former president of USI. Thank you both very much for joining me in studio this morning. Such a pleasure to have people actually in studio with me. So thank you both for coming in and giving of your Sunday morning.